Morning. If you're visiting us, as Vinny said in the announcements, we're spending some time in the book of Daniel. We've been in Daniel for several weeks now, and we'll be there for the next month and a half or so. Once in a while, I do weddings. And I have one wedding sermon. Now, it's not like one thing that I just pull out. I mean, like that, like I break glass and pull it out. I mean, but if you were like studying them as if they were studying or something, there's generally one theme that comes out. And it's the theme that the love it takes to begin a marriage is generally not what it takes to finish one. What brings people together is natural love. What keeps people together is a supernatural love which bears out in patience and mercy and grace and understanding. But if I was going to revise that, it would be this. I would revise it this way. I think that there's a strange tension between knowing and loving. Sometimes it seems to us that you can know someone, but then it becomes difficult to love them. Right? You can see them truly, almost with like a clinical distance or something, or a kind of detachment, like in Seinfeld, right? Like there's rules for Seinfeld. One of the things they said made it a success. No learning, no hugging. So when you have that kind of detached distance, you can know someone. It's very hard to love. And you can love someone, but when you really love them, when you really are drawn up into your soul with their soul and your being with their being, it becomes hard to know them, right? Because you sort of editorially glance at them. You know, you have this. But really, the promise of relationships, marriage, and deep friendships, deep family relationships, deep community relationships, but marriage is paradigmatic in some ways for this, is it's the promise of uniting knowledge and love. And it's perilous, it's precarious, it's hard, but yet it's full of promise. I think that in the book of Daniel, there's like something akin to this precarious balance. If you have been with us over the past few weeks, the first six chapters are stories. Some of them are stories that if you know the Old Testament a little bit, you might be familiar with, like Daniel in the lion's den, or these Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego getting thrown into this fiery furnace. In fact, it's a book that we have lots of colloquialisms in our culture that are derived from. Like that person has clay feet. It's a statue in chapter 2, or the writing on the wall, which is from chapter 5 in this story where this king sees this finger of God right on the wall. But I think that the chapters we're going to get into over the next few weeks are a little, like, for lack of a better term, weirder. They're not these earthy stories. They're stories of cosmic visions. They're these things that seem to give us a glimpse into the destiny of not just Daniel and his compatriots that find themselves exiled in this foreign land, but the story of the whole cosmos. Now, it's sort of like, I think that text like this, it's sort of like, it's almost like when we encounter God, we want to both know and love God. And part of knowing and loving God is taking the whole story. Because this is what real relationships are, right? To have a real relationship with somebody, you can't just editorialize the parts of the story that make you uncomfortable, right? To really know and be known, you have to take the person all as they are. And likewise, these stories, which they may not be as things that are readily connectable, but I think they're profound, and they're stories that actually the nature of them, for reasons that I hope we'll see in a few moments, are just essential. They're essential to how we all live our lives. So with that being said, let's pray. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. You, O Lord, who are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So quickly, simple outline, okay? What I want to talk for a few minutes about what the vision meant, what it probably would have meant to the people who, to Daniel, to the original people that heard it, and then we'll talk a little bit about what it means. Why is it not just a piece of ancient literature, but why it actually has relevance today. So what it meant. Now, on one level, this is, in some sense, straightforward, right? Daniel has this vision, and it's actually a part of the book that backtracks a little bit. Like, if you've been with us, or if you're familiar a little bit with the book of Daniel, the book spans Daniel's lifetime, and he's with several kings as a kind of court executive type of figure. And actually, Belshazzar is a king that we've met before and has fallen away after the Persians have taken over Babylon. And so it's like a retrospect, like Lost or something, right? You know, there's flashbacks. But what's interesting to note is the rest of Daniel up to this point is narrated third person. It's stories about Daniel. This is Daniel speaking in the first person. So it's interesting, right, that the thing that seems maybe the most abstract and the most cosmic and the most strange and the most symbolic is actually him talking in the first person, right? It's sort of like we were talking as we were meeting before worship, we were talking about dreams we have, and, you know, these fantastic things you have in your dreams, right? But it's all related to things that are happening to you during the day or during the week when your subconscious just can't get to rest and just starts populating these characters, right? That's why you're everyone in your dreams, right? Because your mind's generating it. So oftentimes, sometimes these abstract and vibrant pictures are actually really ways that we're looking at our own stories. But here, Daniel has this vision. And again, it's weird. And these four beasts emerge from the sea. And there's this drama that continues to unfold, right? One comes after the other. And then the fourth beast seems really different, right? It seems greater, seems more fierce, is like nothing they'd seen before. And then there's this sense that these kingdoms, these beasts, their season will run its course, and that things will pass away, and this figure, the Ancient of Days, right, this word or image for God, for the one from in which we live and move and have our being, this one, this mysterious figure, he will reign, and he will rule. Then Daniel asks, well, okay, I love this. This is sort of like, it's almost like like people that screen a movie. You know how sometimes they will show a movie and they'll have like a test screener. Screeners, and they'll say, well, here's the thing. It's a great movie, but we don't like this ending, right? This is also what killed I Am Legend, right? The other ending was better. It's on YouTube. You can see it. But then they field test it and people are like, oh, it's just, we don't like the way it feels. And then you figure, okay, let's make something horrible and people will love it. But it's almost like Daniel's like, hey, I want to see more about the fourth beast. I mean, come on, you can't leave me hanging here. And there's a little more detail about the fourth beast and the enduring struggle that will come. But even though the struggle is mapped out in a little more detail, there's a similar ending as before. But we get a little more of a picture of this one who is like a son of man, and who is clearly coming in from the Ancient of Days side of things, but yet looks like, even though he has this sort of transcendence, this sort of mystery about him, but he's still also rooted in our world. And with his coming, everything changes. And then when Daniel gets the sense of this, then there's this sort of thing. I changed colors, right? That's maybe happened to some of you before. It's happened to me on a boat once. I was only probably 1 mile away from, not even from the shore, on the Chesapeake, and a little wind blew up, and I changed colors. But I'll have you know, the captain of the boat said it was the worst squall he had ever seen on the Chesapeake. Very kind captain. Made me feel better. Now, this is, again, that's just sort of a recap of the story. Now, there are a lot of interesting exegetical details that we could mill over. But I'm just going to tell you what I think. But know that I've read books and things, but that doesn't mean I'm right or anything, but I'm trying to give you the best exegetical wisdom that I can. I think there are sort of two ways you could fall off the log on looking at this text. Okay, one would be to see it as exclusively about the future, right? And then sort of trying to look and say, okay, well, I mean, Soviet Union's a bear. Maybe it's the bear. He's on his side next to, well, China's down there below it and on his side. And he's going to, you know, I mean, you could do all the stuff, right? And every generation of the church tends to think that this was written especially for them, as if it was canonized, like in case of, you know, this era, break glass, come out, and it's the roadmap. In fact, there are some churches where if the rapture happens and you're left, you can buy a DVD and it will tell you how to negotiate through the rapture if you're left behind. Which, all right, that's a little cool. But whether or not you believe in the rapture, it's interesting. Likewise, the other way we could fall off the log is that to see this as simply historical reflection, right, as something that's simply doing political cartoons or something, right? That because there are, I think, symbols laden in this, right? It's funny because I was asking a group of students, undergrads, not too long ago, if they understood what it would mean if they saw a cartoon where a bear and an eagle were boxing each other in a ring. And most of them had no idea. Right? Now, that's, for those of you who are older, I mean, unlike me, but I know some of you, but some of you who have told me about this, you would know that that's the Soviet Union and the United States, but it doesn't take long for a world power to fall off the stage, and then all of a sudden the whole symbology is lost. So that's something that just happened a few years ago. So there are images here that meant something in the immediate context, something powerful, something palpable, and yet it's not just a running political commentary in the day's events either. It's a genre in the Bible called apocalyptic literature. And what apocalyptic literature does is it gives a reading of this world and its events, but sort of like pulling back the curtain, pulling back the veil, like the director's cut, saying what's really going on behind it. It allows you to see the story in the middle of the story. It gives you a privileged view of the way the story is unfolding in a way you otherwise wouldn't have. And in the present, and usually it's delivered in tumultuous times, in the present gives you a sense of how the present relates to the past, where we've been and where we're going. Now, that's interesting. Everybody loves, well, not everybody. If I say everybody, now you're alienated. Okay, many of you love post-apocalyptic sort of literature, right, or films. I mean, I think it's a fascinating genre. For me, it's the best. I'll see anything that's post, even The Postman. I even like The Postman. Revolutions is stretching my threshold, but I like The Postman. Now, what's interesting about that genre, I think one of the reasons we're drawn into it is because it creates fear. Right? That what happens in post-apocalyptics, whether it's zombies, whether it's, well, it's often, okay, it's almost always zombies now, but it wasn't always zombies. Whether it's zombies or some other sort of nuclear event that destroys the very fabric of reality, what happens is, like, so much of our life is built on systems of control and bureaucracies, and so much of us, right, how often do you just feel like you're just kind of being shuffled around one thing to the next, right? And then, all of a sudden, what if we took all that away? Who would you be? What if there's nobody telling you what to do? What if the whole systems of etiquette and political correctness and morality were pulled away, and you're just left there in bare naked humanity, maybe animal humanity? Who would you be? What would family come to mean? What would friendship come to mean? What would be the new bonds of loyalty? Who would be a neighbor? Who would be an enemy? What would it mean to fall in love in a world like that? Maybe you wouldn't know who you were. Maybe the who you think you are would totally dissipate. For some of us, that'd be a liberating thing. Maybe it would bring our best selves. For some of us, the thing people think is our best selves is really a shadow self, an imposter, a fraudulent thing we've designed. Most of us are probably somewhere in between. That's what's so fearful about it. It's the fear, not just of society falling apart, but also the fear of remembering what Chesterton says. Chesterton says, the tragedy of the world. And, oh, man, I mean, this is one of the great things ever said. The tragedy of the world is that we've all forgotten who we are. And what makes it worse is that most of us have forgotten that we've forgotten. You're just shuffling along. And so the fear is what happens when you remember. Could that be a scary sense of awareness? Now, apocalyptic literature in the Bible isn't meant to create fear. It's meant to create faith. It's not meant to strike terror into the hearts of God's people. It's actually meant, in the midst of situations that can be terrible and terrifying, to encourage faith. It's actually meant to stabilize the people of God, not to totally pull the threat away. Although it will smash some idols that maybe serve as tattered clothes for us, but it won't tear the truth thread of the garments God cloaks us in. It's meant to create faith. And I think that's exactly what this story does. Now, I'm just going to, before we say what it means, I'm just going to give you I'll tell you what I think it means, and it might sound obvious to some of you, it may not. I think the beasts, I think, are four successive kingdoms. So the first is Babylon. The second is the Medo-Persian Empire, the Persians that come and take over the Babylonians, right? Or the second. The third is, I think, the Greeks and this leopard who has these wings, right? It's a leopard's already fast, and you put wings on it, well, it's faster. It's like a Cannonball Run. Sammy Davis Jr. says he and Dean Martin are doing the cannonball in a Ferrari, and they say, well, you're a priest in a Ferrari? He says, yeah, we're doing the Lord's work. In a Ferrari, you can do it faster. Well, a leopard can, you know, run around faster with wings, like sort of leaping like the Incredible Hulk or something. But that's probably Alexander the Great. And the last that is unlike anybody, and yet still a kingdom, is the Roman Empire. Now, the reason why I don't think... Now, I understand there's an interpretive tradition that sees that is not a viable interpretation, because this text is talking about the end of the world. Well, yeah, it is. Because from the conviction of the writers of the New Testament, right? Augustine has this great saying that in the Old Testament, the new is concealed. In the Old Testament, the new is concealed. In the New Testament, the old is revealed. And so the end of the world is the coming of Jesus Christ. That's the atom bomb in human history. It's not a speculative darkening of the sky that will come at the end of time. From the perspective of the New Testament authors, that's just the mop-up operation. It's the difference between D-Day and V-Day, right? I mean, when the Allies landed on D-Day into Europe, the war was really over. I mean, there was mopping up to do, and there was lives lost, and there were battles to be fought. But that was the decisive moment. V-Day wasn't the decisive moment. D-Day was the decisive moment. And likewise, D-Day is not some time at the end of time. D-Day is the one like the Son of Man, the one who is from God's side and on our side, coming into the middle of history. And he comes in the time of the Roman Empire. An empire, a beast like no one had ever seen before. And if you doubt that, just watch Spartacus or something like that, right? Watch how, I don't know, okay, that's really, don't, we could edit that out. That'd be great. Watch the History Channel or read books about it. Right? But, I mean, it was an empire, the likes of which, the power of which, the bureaucracy of which, the reach of which, the world had not seen. Just had not seen. So, that's, I think, the scope of the visions. Right? It's these four kingdoms and how they'll sequentially play out in this life of the story of God's people. So now, what it means. That's sort of my historical overview there. What it means, because it has perennial lessons. Notice the beasts all come out of the sea. They all come out of the sea. Now, if you're a beach lover or a sailing lover, this is going to sound bad to you, and that's okay. It's maybe not a universal cultural symbol or something, but Israel are not a seafaring people. So, I mean, Sea of Galilee, fishing boat, that's about as seaworthy as an Israelite's going to get, right? I mean, this is not the kind of people that birth Jacques Cousteau's, okay? Or even Nemo's or anything like that. So, for them, the sea is just a universally negative kind of image. It's the place where things that you can't control, things that threaten you, things that are awful, they all come out of the sea. Things that that threaten the very safety and fabric of the sort of day-to-day life that we take for granted, they all come out of the sea. Likewise, these are all unclean animals. Okay, Israel, you know, Israel with the tradition of the law and clean things and unclean things. These are unclean animals. And they'd be like perversely unclean because the author of Leviticus loves to say, each according to its kind, and this thing goes here. And I sympathize with that. That's why I don't like casseroles, right? Each according to its kind. I want the meat here. I want the vegetables here. I don't want to throw it all in. It's Levitical, right? Everything's got to have a little boundary. So it's like, this is going to sound like nails on a chalkboard because not only are these unclean animals, they're unclean animals that are composite. Like, why is there wings on a leopard? Oh my gosh, cats and dogs living together. I mean, this is just awful. They're unqualifyingly bad, contrasted with the Ancient of Days, who looks more like a person. White hair. I mean, it's anthropomorphic, right? It's because Israel has been conquered, victimized by a stronger empire. If this isn't the sea, I don't know what is. And then it happens subsequently throughout the exile. If these rulers and kingdoms don't look like unclean beasts emerging right from the ocean of your worst nightmare, I don't know what does. And yet, God is in control of them. God is in control. While there is a duality here, it's not a dualism. Okay, there is a difference here. There are things that are serving God explicitly, and ones that are serving His purposes unwittingly. They're not waking up saying, "Gosh, how could we as unclean pagan imperialists serve the Ancient of Days today? What can we do? What's our agenda today?" No, I mean, they're not doing it wittingly, but unwittingly, they are being woven into the tapestry of the mosaic that God is weaving. So this is where I think what Israel has to learn is, look, despite, and this is a hard lesson, it was hard to learn then, it's hard to learn now, that the things that give us the most terror and anxiety, the things that frighten us, horrify us, whether it's a people group, whether it's a political party, whether it's the threat to national security, whether it's the threat of financial instability, whatever it is, our tendency is to just say, oh my gosh, that's this demonic thing that like it is unruly, out of control, and we've got to muzzle it because, gosh, if that thing gets loose, all is lost. I think that, now, this is not to say that there aren't real enemies in the world. There aren't things we ought to be afraid of and be fearful of, and yet, what happens when you lose sight of the fact that God is the Ancient of Days and sovereign even over these imperial powers that have the worst intentions is that you begin to separate yourself from the table of sinners and you separate the other from the fellowship of humanity. You forget that they're made in the image of God just like you. You forget that they've been victimized probably at some point in their story or at some point in this people group story, and that's why they're so quick to victimize you. It doesn't mean that you can't be angry. It doesn't mean that there aren't real feelings, but if you lose sight of this, that those feelings will be planted in the soil of anxiety, resentment, hatred, and that soil just grows up weeds like crazy, and the next thing you know, you'll be overgrown and feel bound. Contrast how the beasts look with how God looks. He looks like a person. White hair. White is sort of color for purity and holiness here. Think of like, well, I was going to say like these pants would be something a priest could wear maybe under his Levitical robe or something. If you're listening to the podcast, as if we have lots of listeners, but I'm wearing white pants. But and they're linen. But you think, so God, there's fire and flames, which is a symbol for judgment. That ultimately, you know, the story of human history, the tragedy of human history, if you take the Bible seriously, which you should, because it's true. If you take the Bible seriously, and you'll find it's true if you really get into it existentially, you'll find it really, I think, sheds light on the story of not just your life, but the human condition in general. The story of human history takes the wrong turn when our first parents decide they're better judges than their creator. That they can say what to eat and what not to eat. They can say, set the terms for how they'll move and work in the world. And when you separate the creation from the creator, things go awry. But no matter how awry it goes, God is still the judge. God is still sovereign and in control. And you notice that his throne is mobile. There's wheels. It's not like a little rascal. I mean, Scooter, it's a different image. It might be less threatening today. But then it was threatening, trust me. It's that. Look, he's quicker than Alexander the Great. He's quicker than these beasts that seem to defy the limits that imagination can set. He's quicker than the Roman Empire. He's quicker than the anxiety that springs up when you see that person who conjures up all the worst feelings in you. He's quicker than that. He's there. He's not absent. He's present. And he's present not in spite of that, but sometimes he's present because of it. That I think the message to Israel is this is going to be hard to hear, but in this exile you're at, in this time where things have been ripped from you, and it seems like things could never, never get better or more redemptive, this is actually the time, it's a crucial time, when some of the threads of the story are really going to come together. And there's a temptation, and we see this over and over in these exilic books like Daniel, there's a temptation if when the Israelites are booted into exile to either set up a religious ghetto and just say, hey, those are the bad people over here. We're the good people over here. God's story may go on, but it doesn't include any of this. Or the other tendency would be to kind of assimilate and say, well, I mean, I believed in the Lord when we had David and Solomon, but come on, I'm a today guy. Babylon won. We got to get with their agenda. We got to go along to get along. Keep on keeping on. But what God's instruction to the exiles is to be in and out of the world, to be in Babylon, and to not resent it, and yet to not be of it, to realize that there's no place in this Christian. I hate, you ever hear that term, this God-forsaken place? Maybe you've said it before. Maybe you've heard it said, a place that it just evokes all kind of dread or all kind of prejudice in you or all kind of memories of awful things. You say, this is a God-forsaken place. There are no God-forsaken places. And the quickest thing when our back's against the wall, when everything is disoriented, when the rug is ripped out from us, the quickest temptation to say is, this is a God-forsaken place. And the message is, no, there's not. Even in the midst of the sea that's spewing out beasts, it's not a God-forsaken place. Because the Ancient of Days, with a fire that not just destroys, but refines. Not just breaks apart, but brings together, integrates, makes whole, shinier, more beautiful. That Ancient of Days is drawn into your story. He's much more powerful, much more enduring than even the fourth beast. One like a son of man came riding on the clouds. In Daniel 2, if you are familiar with the book of Daniel, there's another dream about a statue, again, where we get this idea of clay feet. And really, this vision is sort of a different take on that statue. And the statue has bronze and gold and clay at the bottom. It's sequentially, it's laying out the same succession of kingdoms that's going to be the path to the coming of Jesus. I have a friend once, we went to college together, and his freshman, he didn't grow up in the church, really in a churchy scene, neither did I. And we were in this Bible study, and we were talking about the Apostles' Creed. We're both from Jersey, and he just says, "Dude, why are we talking about Pilate? Like, why do we give him all this credit, dude? Like, why does he get in the creed? He seems shady." It's because these people in history, these political, ruthless and yet indecisive people, even them, are bound up in this story. That the one who would end history in the middle of history, Jesus the Christ, is like Daniel 2 says, a stone not made with hands. Who comes in and changes everything. Hemingway in A Farewell to Arms says this: the world breaks everyone, and afterward many are strong in the broken places, but those that will not break it kills. It kills the very good and the very gentle and the very brave impartially. In Daniel 2, there's this image, and Jesus picks up on this. That he says that the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, the capstone. What happens is this one who holds the key to human history and the key to your history and your story, no matter what it is, you have two options. And this, if this sounds like extreme, it's just sometimes in life things aren't either or. Sometimes they are. And this is sort of an either or for the New Testament. He will crush you or break you. You can be broken on him, but you can trust him because he was broken for you. See, he was the king that won through losing. He was the one who traded places with you. He undid the empire, not by building a more violent empire, but by going into the heart of the violence and swallowing it up. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis talks about after one of the characters has been a betrayer, how betrayal is undone. He says there's at the beginning of time, there was a deeper magic that the witch didn't know of, and that's the one that broke the table, and that's the one by which the sinner was set free. Jesus knew that it came into the theater of empires and spun the deeper magic and lived the deeper magic. So this is why it's just better to be broken than get crushed. Because you're going to, Hemingway's right. The world, let me tell you what, I mean, it's not the creation's bad. It's not, but it's hard. Right? Talk to me. I just defy you to find someone in this room for whom life is not hard. Doesn't matter how good you have it. Life is hard. And it's hard because in a moment's time, stuff can just come up out of the sea. You can be having the best day in the world, and that relative calls that totally disempowers you and takes you back to that time when you're an 11-year-old and felt incompetent. Things that you feel like you're recovering from the divorce, and then something comes, and you just can't handle it, and all of a sudden you feel like you're back further than you started. You manage this image of yourself, and you think it's good, and then you're found out. You play by all the rules in your business, and somehow something happens, and it's still taken away. And in those situations, you can either be broken and know that you get stronger in the broken places. Because the story of Jesus is one in which the one broken is the one that is key to making things whole. Or you get crushed. In conclusion, I just want to share a quote that I've shared before. Reinhold Niebuhr says 6 months into his first pastorate, he realized he preached all the same sermons. So maybe that's true, but this is from Frank Lake, a book called Clinical Theology. He says, so far as our own subjective feelings are concerned, any inner-directed questioning of our basic human state may produce the same dismal answer as before. The cupboard is bare. Now, what he's saying there is that, you know, you start to think about your life and say, what's it worth? Am I a good parent? Am I a good boss? Am I a good employee? Am I a good son? Am I a good church member? Whatever. And you look, and gosh, it looks like, gosh, the cupboard is bare. There's no china in there. It's just empty and creepy and dusty with cobwebs. I've got nothing to serve with. While we regard our humanity as a container which ought to have something good in it, when we look inside, we miss the whole point of the paradox. We are not meant to be self-contained, but channels of the life and energies of God himself. From this point of view, our wisdom is to let the bottom be knocked out of our humanity, which will ruin it as a container at the same time as it turns it into a satisfactory channel. Being broken, having the bottom knocked out, allows you to be a channel for life. Praise be to God. Amen.